Fixing hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to an FU commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Part two.
I'm Greg Wyshynski, ESPN, the worldwide leader in sports. Maybe you've heard of us.
I'm Ryan Lambert from Elite Prospects. I guarantee you've heard of us.
Sean McAdoo from a little startup called The Athletic. You probably haven't heard of us, but we're doing our best.
Scrappy underdog. You're in Puck Soup. I've heard of Elite Prospects because it's where I go to find out where a random person who's been traded is playing. It's great for that. I love it. It's fantastic for that. I also like my favorite thing about Elite Prospects, besides the incredible chronicle of KHL stats that is always there for people that hop over or are playing over there, is the part where you find out whose uncle played in the NHL.
Yeah,
it's one of my favorite parts.
That's always so interesting because it's like, oh, this guy's like second cousin played in the NHL in 1974, and you're like, all right, great. Recently I was looking at a college hockey prospect who was like, you know, his aunt is Manon Raume, and I was like, hey, all right, great. That's fun.
Yeah, it's awesome. I just want to go there one day and see, like, you know, Father Cole and Sidney Crosby. And I'm like, what?
Yeah, I mean,
we didn't know. Who knew?
Yeah, I mean, they showed Rob Brind'Amour last night on the broadcast, NBC. They showed, like, video of him running his son's U-10 hockey tryouts. And it's like, yeah we're, like, eight years away from whatever – Cooper Brind'Amour, I don't know what his kid's name is, but, you know, whatever. from him being, like, you know, one of the eight best hockey prospects in the world, and we just have to be like, yeah, I mean, I guess, like, he retired, like, 3 years ago, I feel like, but okay, sure.
I've often told the story that the first time I ever felt old doing this job was the year that Landon Ferraro got drafted, and I was like, not only do I remember his dad playing hockey, I remember his dad being on TV talking about hockey. And now he is drafted.
Yeah, the Kachuk the boys. First time. Another.
Yeah, exactly. Right. The draft has a very handy way of making you feel the sands passing through the hourglass.
My best one was from baseball. I remember when Cecil Fielder was still with the Blue Jays, and he would bring his very chonky kid onto the field. And they were like, look, this 8-year-old is like already hitting the ball 300 feet. That's crazy. And it was Prince Fielder, and he ended up being like a major star in the big leagues years later. But you're like, holy crap, I remember that kid when he was actually a kid.
I remember being very upset when I found out that his name was Prince because he blew the opportunity to name his kid left, center, or right. Yeah. All of which would have
well,
been
Cecil wasn't doing a lot of outfield work, let's just say. So I think he knew what was up. I don't think designated hitter would have worked. So
yeah, utility middle. This is my son, utility middle.
Not to like get off on and make this baseball soup or whatever.
No,
but
let's
like,
do it.
I feel like Edgar Martinez ruined the DH.
By being good
like
at
me.
It.
Yeah, by being good at it, exactly, because and Joe Carter to a certain extent, too, because back in the day, I used to love when big, sloppy, fat fucks that couldn't play the field were your DH, right? Like your Ken Phelps's, your Dan Pasquas, or your...
Yeah, I don't think you need to worry. Like, that's still what the DH is. Like, David Ortiz...
Is it still pretty, like that?
Yeah, of course. Not that David Ortiz
oh, David
is still
Ortiz.
Playing, but... Like, David
right,
Ortiz
yeah,
was a guy
example.
Where it's like, well, shit, I mean, he can knock the fucking cover off a baseball, but... I don't want to put him at first base under any circumstances. And then, you know, when the Red Sox would inevitably go to the World Series and David Ortiz would have to play first base, it was always an adventure, you know?
It was always a fair trade-off. It's like it wasn't a fair trade-off, actually. It was like, not only do your pitchers have to hit now, but then your big sloppy guy has to actually play the field.
Yeah, so
it
sucks. Just,
National League revenge on that one.
Yeah, well, I don't recall it really working out too well for whatever National League team had to play the Red Sox while David Ortiz was playing for them. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, get get rid of the frickin' pitcher's hitting thing. Unless it's Shohei Ohtani, in which case.
Yeah. And then it's a special.
Did you see that last night?
Yeah.
470? Ridiculous.
Insane how good that guy is.
Incredible. I don't want to, again, like, well, the DH thing is a debate for another day, but have either of you been following the sticky goo baseball pitcher thing that Pruitt wrote about?
Yeah.
Yep.
So what is this about? Like, I haven't really followed it. I've been very hockey-minded. It's like a legal sticky thing they're putting on the ball?
Yeah, pretty much. Okay. And they asked Garrett Cole about it, and he was like...
I saw that.
You know, sticky substances are a land of contrasts. didn't have a fucking answer at all. It sucked.
It was one of those deals where...
About it.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had to know he was going to get asked at some point, but, like, the thing I loved about it was very much the, I'm not saying I'm doing it, but I'm not saying it's bad, but if it is bad, I'm just saying I'm not doing it.
It's in a tradition.
It's like, oh, that's right. That was the thing that killed me. It was like, certain traditions are passed down from generation to generation, and then you learn it's bad. It's like, what are you talking about? A fucking plantation ball? Like, what is going on here? It's like, I felt his struggle. Because he's talking about something that he probably knows will be banned after this season, but doesn't really want to like dabble in it.
Yeah, but yeah, you gotta ban Barry Bonds from the Hall of Fame because he took steroids that time. So
yeah, to put it in terms that hockey fans could understand, like imagine like a hypothetical world where scoring in the NHL went way down, and as part of that. Let's just say the goalies started wearing illegal equipment. And everybody was like, hey, the goalies seem to pretty obviously be wearing illegal equipment. And then the league was like, we kind of have rules, but we don't really enforce it, but maybe we will eventually. Anyways, Major League Baseball is a professional league run by actual leaders. So they're going to take care of it and not just wait 20 years to do anything about it. But that's sort of what it would be like. I know it's hard to imagine, but that's the best I can do.
Goalies are wearing illegal equipment. They should really change it. And then J.S. Jaguar bursts through the wall and goes, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
He's like, then the equivalent would be him going, well, look, I mean, does illegal equipment, maybe, but also, who's to say? And certainly I have never, but if I did and could, then, you know.
Yeah.
Right. And he's like, it's been passed down from generation to generation. Exactly, and Grant Fuhr is like, I'm literally wearing pantyhose.
Yeah, regular shin pads.
In 1980, sir. Yeah. It's not been passed down from any generation to generation. All right. Gallant effort to bring it back to hockey, Sean. Montreal, holy shit. A big sweeperoo. They advance. As we do the show, by the way, we should mention that the Colorado Vegas series is approaching game six, and then game six of Boston New York is tonight. So we'll talk around those series a little bit, but let's start with the one that we know is Fine, which is Montreal advancing over Winnipeg. I've been candid with my struggles about Montreal, trying to find reasons to like this team and to get past the notion that they just are a team with a giant golden horseshoe shoved up their ass. As far as how many breaks they've gotten.
Well,
but let's start with you, Ryan. Tell me your feelings on Les Habitants these days.
I think they were clearly all season a better team than the Winnipeg Jets, but they didn't get the goaltending that Winnipeg does because Winnipeg has the best goalie in the world. And, you know, like Carey Price is certainly playing at a comparable level, I guess you would say, at this point. But the idea that, like... You know, I wouldn't have called a sweep, but I thought the Habs were going to be pretty comfortable favorites unless Hellebuck stood on his head, and he only sort of did. So, like, again, you know, the thing with Montreal is, and this is a problem going back for many years, is they have a pretty mediocre roster, I think you would say. Like, no real stars on it, although, you know, maybe Cole Caulfield and Nick Suzuki become that. Or are becoming that now, I guess. But, you know, the Winnipeg Jets roster, once you get the top line off the ice, or, you know, Mark Scheifele gets suspended.
yeah.
You know, once you get those guys off the ice, you're like, yeah, I guess these guys really aren't that good. Like that. Yeah, that's really what it boils down to for me.
Outside of maybe whatever line Ehlers is on, and then you get past.
I mean, that's a whole different thing where it's like, yeah, maybe Nick Ehlers shouldn't be like eighth in forward ice time on this team. But what do I know? I'm not coach for life in Winnipeg. So
I was surprised. I thought the Jets would be more dangerous in this.
More of a fight for sure. Yeah. But yeah, they just
offensively.
Totally,
I mean, we all looked at that team and went, well, you know, if they need Hellebuck beat the top and the blue line is not great, but you figured that they could score a little bit more. I mean, look, it's two series in a row for Montreal, right? Where they've been facing a team with a really dangerous top six that then lost a key part of that top six, and suddenly it kind of started looking like a top three. And that's life, though. I mean, have they been lucky, had some breaks? Yeah. Every team that goes deep in the playoffs has some luck at some point. And I don't, you know, it's one of those was a fluke accident, and one of them was somebody on the other team being a dumbass and taking himself out of the series. So,
well, from what I understand, it was actually Dobbs who eliminated. That's the funniest thing that anybody's ever said.
Speaking of guys who had a week to think of what they were going to say,
Mark Scheifele said that he thought that Philip Deneau was going to take him out of the series, and then it turned out to be the Department of Player Safety, which is honestly a clever line, but also founded in just absolute abject.
Well, what's also funny is he's like, yeah, oh no, I was totally expecting to go into this series and get owned by Phil Deneau. Like, I thought he was going to kick my ass up and down the ice, but I didn't even give him the chance.
You know, we saw this last year where they lost Scheifele, and they bounced back and they won a game. Kind of like how when the Leafs lost Tavares, they bounced back and won a few games.
But three, at some point, I think, is the number.
Yeah, three. But at some point, you feel the loss. And in Winnipeg's case, I think in the back of their minds, they kind of remembered how hapless they were with him out of the lineup last year in the bubble. And then they see him, you know, go out through his own self-annihilation in game one, and then they just got all kind of rainy-faced about it. You know, they probably knew they couldn't beat this team without a functioning top line, and if Scheifele's not on the line, it's not going to be any good.
I guess. I don't know. I mean, that's a pretty big indictment of that group. Because right. Even with Scheifele out and down a game, you're not overmatched against this Montreal team. Like, you should be absolutely in that series.
But indict away. Like, that's the reality of this team, is that you take Scheifele off that line, and you take Scheifele out of this lineup, then what do you have left? I mean, it's just the way the team is built. I mean, it's the way they've chosen to build the team. But I don't know. I was shocked it was a sweep, but once Scheifele took himself out of the series, you kind of read the writing on the wall, especially with the way that Montreal has been defending.
Yeah. And they've been playing well. Like, Montreal,
yeah, they're good.
Give them credit,
they're a
man.
Solid
they're
team.
This is not like, look, I've it's no secret. I'm no big fan of defensive hockey. And I think if Montreal goes on a run and actually wins this thing, I think that's very bad for the league on some level. But also, this isn't some passive team that's just sitting back and trying to grind the game into nothing. Like, they're pretty ferocious out there.
Yeah.
It's a system that only works if everybody is fully bought in 100% on every shift. And that's harder. That's a lot easier said than done. And they're doing it. They're pulling it off. So credit to them.
Yeah. I mean, and to my earlier point, this is a team that generally has underperformed its expected goals numbers because of that lack of like real star talent. And also, that's the same reason why they've generally underperformed on special teams in particular. The power play is still not very good, but now they're actually killing penalties, and it's because Carey Price is standing on his head. And, you know, if you can stand on get a goalie who stands on his head and capitalize on breakaways and stuff like that, which they did a lot of. Winnipeg as is its wont, gave up a lot of odd man rushes and breakaways, including one to Shea Weber in one of the games, which is like, that shouldn't be allowed to happen. But like that's why they won, is because they effectively killed penalties, which is the only thing Winnipeg's been good at all year. You know, they were a terrible 5-on-5 team. And so for the Habs, who are a good 5-on-5 team, to kick their asses at it, you know, that makes perfect sense.
That's a big part of it, yeah.
Yeah, and but so...
I
don't know. I've just seen, like, this... I'm already seeing bits and pieces of it floating around out there where it's like... People look at this Montreal team and they're like, yeah, this is what happens, right? In the regular season, the teams that can score are going to win, but in the playoffs, they stop calling the rule book, and teams like this can just... Montreal's not clutching and grabbing and tackling guys to keep them off the score. Like, trust me, there was no montage in that Leaf series of Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner getting hauled down over and over again and uncalled this and that. Like, if that had been out there, they would have put that on TV and we'd all be talking about it. And the reason you didn't see it is because it wasn't happening. They're a physical team. They're an aggressive team. But this isn't, you know, this isn't the 96 Panthers just water skiing behind guys and assuming the refs are going to put the whistle away. There's more to it than that, and they deserve credit.
First off, thank you for not referencing the 95 Devils in that comparison. I always appreciate that. Secondly, like I agree, and I think the acknowledgement that skill can win you regular season games but not necessarily postseason games is more about the style of play changing versus the rule book not being called. And I think that's, I mean, you talk to any player and they'll tell you that there's less ice, you know, there's less open ice for you in the playoffs just because of how tightly everybody's playing and how focused everybody is on a 7-game series versus an 82-game marathon. And so I kind of buy it, to be honest with you, Sean. Like, I buy the idea that it's the teams. I mean, you look at, I mean, I hate to bring them up because they're just like a model franchise right now, but the Lightning are a team that can beat you with skill in the regular season and, quite frankly, in the postseason. But they also have, like, a collection of role players that can also win stylistically playoff hockey-wise, too.
The Ross Coltons of the world who...
Yeah, well, I was thinking more like the Alex Killorns of the world.
Believe me, I saw Ross Colton play a lot of hockey. I don't look at that guy and go, now there's a man with some skill in reserve. And yet...
But it's just like, someone pointed out though that like now it's like now they have an assembly line of these types of guys.
Yes.
Like it's like fucking guy goes down, here's Ross Colton scoring a goal. Guy goes down last year, here's Carter Verhaeghe scoring a goal. Like what the fuck? It's just insane how
Alex Barry Bure is going to be the next one. He's the Syracuse guy who's kicking ass these days. And yeah, I don't know. Wild. Like they are good at drafting and developing talent in a way that. You know, most teams aren't. And it seems like that's a most teams problem, because if you can turn Ross Colton, who wasn't a particularly good college hockey player, into, he's the kind of guy who can take over a game five against the Carolina Hurricanes. It's like, well, what are they doing so differently, you know, that they can just create those guys out of nothing every single year?
It's crazy. Last thing on the Habs, Sean, you were mentioning before the show the CN Tower thing. Can you explain that for the Americans who may not understand why the most iconic building in Toronto was lit up in Montreal colors this week?
Yeah, the CN Tower is owned and operated by a federal crown corporation, which is not quite the same as saying that they're run by the federal government, but it's kind of in that ballpark. So yeah, they're going to do national things, not Toronto things. And plus, it's a tourist attraction, so they're not going to only cater to a Toronto audience. They want people from elsewhere in the country to come visit them. So, I kind of cringed like everyone else when I saw that they were flying Montreal colors. But if people honestly don't understand why that's happening, then I don't really know what to tell you. It's the Empire State Building flies other teams' colors too. Like this is just kind of a thing that these sorts of buildings do. So I don't know. It feels like of all the things you could get your licks in on Toronto these days, this was a weird story to blow up the way it did.
And just to be clear, the C does not stand for cuck, right? In CN Tower?
I don't think so.
It stands for Canadian.
Yeah. And, oh. Yeah.
That's okay, why. Well,
synonymous. Tampa gets by Carolina. This was kind of a bummer of a series, wasn't it?
Yeah. Bit of a letdown.
Like, I felt like it was five good games. I just wanted seven
good games. Right,
exactly. Yeah, right, exactly. Right,
I didn't think it wasn't like... like even, you know, some would say the first half of the Toronto-Montreal series where it was like, oh, there's all this hype, and then the games were not very good. I thought the games were good. It's just,
yeah,
fair. I want it more is what I wanted.
I mean, I can't say it was a bad series when you have the kind of batshit insanity that you had in the second period of game four, which was just incredible to watch. But it is one of those that kind of felt like it could be a marathon, and then it wound up being... another assassin-like efficient performance by the Lightning, and it was. But I guess the other bummer though was that they missed Trocheck and Niederreiter for a little bit. They got him back for five, and they were still missing, I think, a couple guys in that game too. But that's the playoffs. Yeah, I don't know. It was it was just kind of the Lightning for the second straight round exerting their will on an upstart opponent. And I don't think. Okay, so if you're Carolina, do you feel real shitty about this, or do you just say, hey? It just, they're better.
They ran into a buzzsaw. I mean, you know, the Lightning are going to pose matchup problems for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Carolina is probably like a top five or six team in the league, but the Lightning are a top two or three team in the league. And so, you know, what are you supposed to do? Sometimes, especially, like you said, there were injuries, and I'm sure that they didn't come back and they were at 100%, you know? So, I on some level, you're like, damn, we had a really good chance. Like, are we going to get this out of Nedeljkovic again? And also, are we going to be able to re-sign Dougie Hamilton again?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, yeah, you're going to feel like you wasted it. But again, you know, like, the playoffs format's very strange. The whole season's been very strange this year. In a normal postseason... You know, they're not playing the Tampa Bay Lightning until at least the conference final. So, you know, it's not like they don't have a good thing going where it's like, we're, you know, the Panthers where it's like, oh, that might have been it for a while. You know, they have a really good chance to be one of the best teams in the Metro again next year when things get back to, you know, the full 82 and you know, they're playing the Rangers and the Islanders in the first couple of rounds instead of the Lightning. But yeah, I mean, when you're a really good team, you're going to kind of look at how things went and go, yeah, we probably should have played more postseason games than this.
Sean, what did you make of, I think Justin Bourne said it recently that, Dougie Hamilton is the apple of Kyle Dubas's eye.
Yeah. I maybe on some level he could be that sort of guy. I don't know how. If you're the Leafs, I don't know how you make that happen.
It also doesn't seem like both he and Morgan Rielly could exist in the same space time.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, we did our last show on last Wednesday. It was the day of, but it was before the Leafs had done their shutdown day. And Brendan Shanahan and Kyle Dubas basically got up there and said, yeah, "We're keeping everything the same. We're keeping the same core. We're gonna push forward with this group." Yeah, there's an argument for doing that. But if you are, then that takes you out of Dougie Hamilton. It takes you out of Seth Jones. Anyone else that big names that might be available that you're looking at, unless you move Morgan Rielly. But the thing with moving Morgan Rielly is, whatever you think of that guy, whether you think he's a top tier first pairing guy or whether you think he's more of a good second pair type guy, at $5 million a year, which is what he's got the last year of his deal next year, $5 million, he's good value, or maybe even great value. And I don't know how you move good or great value contracts out and get better when you're facing a cap crunch. Like, I understand if you're going to keep the big four, he's the next guy on the list. I mean, Anderson's gone. That gives you a little tiny bit of room to work with. If you want anything more than that, you got to move. I mean, Riley's kind of the guy you got to move, but what are you bringing in with that $5 million in cap space that's going to be better than what you had? that's going to be the question for them. So,
yeah.
Yeah, Hamilton's a $9 million defenseman, right? Like, that's
I think he
the
is.
Ultimate
yeah.
issue.
So. It's, yeah, for sure. I mean, you never know. Who knows what the market's going to look like, but certainly, yeah, if he's your day one target, you're going up high on those numbers.
What do you think happens with Brind'Amour?
I've been told that we can't even talk about the fact that he doesn't have a contract yet. I mentioned it a month ago when Friedman was reporting it, because Elliot Friedman doesn't just pull things out of the air. If Elliot Friedman is going on TV saying Rod Brind'Amour doesn't have a contract, it's because somebody involved somewhere in the process wants that out there. And I mentioned it, and I got piled on by Hurricanes fans saying, no, no, the owner has said it's going to get done. Don't worry about it. It's a done deal. And then a little while after that, when the story went out saying that, well, Brind'Amour wants his staff taken care of. Again, weird thing to come out. Sounds like something somebody wanted to put out there. But again, I was told, nope, sure thing. It's a lock. Don't even talk about it. So obviously the most likely scenario by far is he re-signs and he stays there where it's a good fit. But I don't know.
The makes number, you wonder,
the
doesn't
number
it?
That was put out there was quite low. But there's more to life than what the number is. But I'll just say this, you know. Can I picture Rod Brind'Amour leaving the Hurricanes? No, of course not.
No.
Could I picture Barry Trotz leaving the Capitals after winning the Cup? No. Could I picture Mike Keenan bailing on the New York Rangers? No. Stuff happens in this league. So, wow. I guess if the owner says it's going to get done, we just all assume it's going to get done. But this feels like it's a worthwhile story to talk about, but I guess I'm in the minority on that.
No, I mean, Hurricanes fans get a little salty when you bring it up. It's a sensitive area. Today's episode of Puck Soup is sponsored by Manscaped. You almost talked over my amazing transition.
Sorry, bud.
You know, Manscaped is a product.
Okay transition, by the way. It wasn't great. Felt forced.
That is perfect for a little holiday called a Father's Day. It's right around the corner. And you might need a gift for your hairy daddy. You can make your dad proud by getting him the Manscaped Lawnmower 4.0 in the Ultra Smooth Package. You know what they say, like father, like son. The brand new Lawnmower 4.0 and Ultra Smooth Package is perfect for you and the dad in your life to complete your grooming game. And you can get 20% off and free shipping with the promo code PUCK20 at manscaped.com. Now, what are we talking about with this Lawnmower 4.0 trimmer? We're talking about 7,000 RPM trimmer featuring the skin-safe technology to keep all your sensitive areas intact and safe. It's got a multifunction on and off switch that can engage with a travel lock so you can bring with you on the road. And of course, it has a 4,000K LED spotlight when you need a more precise shave. It's great technology. All of us have gotten the Manscaped box. We've all checked out the equipment and then checked out our equipment. And it's a great, great gift for the guy in your life. You get 20% off of free shipping now with the promo code PUCK, P-U-C-K, 20. Sorry, that'd be PUCK 20. P-U-C-K 20 at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code P-U-C-K-20 at manscaped.com. Check out the products. This is obviously not something that everyone's going to be, you know, open and honest and willing to talk about in their lives, but you know who you know, and you know what they look like. So maybe get a Manscaped. It's dad bod season. It's time to get smooth. All right, moving on. Uh-oh, Colorado's in trouble. The Avalanche, as we do this show, is they're down 3-2 in the series, having lost an overtime game on home ice to Mark Stone and the Golden Knights because Ryan Graves tried to shoot the puck through five people, and Mark Stone was smart enough to skate the other way when he saw that happen. The Nathan MacKinnon line shut down pretty handily in this series by the Golden Knights. And if you are an Avalanche fan, you are probably feeling pretty bad about things right now because you were certainly the odds-on favorite to win the Cup. Ryan, how do you see this series having broken down?
Yeah, I mean, Colorado hasn't played well for four games now. They obviously blew Vegas out in the first game, just like absolutely obliterated them. Then won game two kind of by the skin of their teeth and maybe, you know, on the quote-unquote deserve-to-win-it-o-meter. They did not deserve to win it. And then they get their ass kicked again, three straight games. Although, you know, like, it's certainly a situation where you go, well, you know, they're the Colorado Avalanche. If anybody can turn it on in an instant, it's them. And they looked really good for two periods last night, but then that third period happened in Vegas, like, well, we're not losing this game. What are you talking about? So, I don't know. I think it's going to be a tough sell to get me to believe that Marc-Andre Fleury is going to absolutely shit himself at this point. But like I said, if anybody can make a good goalie look bad in short order, it's this Colorado Avalanche team. So,
yeah, series is not over, of course, but Vegas looks real good.
Yeah.
I mean, Vegas, and Ryan's right, it's not three games, it's four games that they have been the significantly better team. And we haven't seen that against the Avalanche since the last place season. Like, literally, have they had a stretch where they've been beaten up like this since then? It's pretty remarkable.
And boy, like the press conference that Jared Bednar had after game four was just very telling. Like, very much just kind of like, you know, calling out the effort and
well, that was game and all that three, stuff. Wasn't it?
Was it game three?
Yeah, game three.
Yeah, game four, he was sort of like a little bit better with it. But like, the thing that I found really fascinating was maybe something that I underrated about the Golden Knights, that at this point, if you are the MacKinnon line, let's say you get away from Stone, you got to then get away from the Marchessault line too. And let's say you get away from Martinez and Pietrangelo. Well, now you got to go get away from Shea Theodore too. Like, they are a very well-constructed team in the sense that they've got two lines that play great at both ends of the rink. And then, you know, the grand plan of getting two number one D, I think, is worked out well, even if, you know, Pietrangelo has not been all that great for them. I think he and Martinez are a really good pairing. So that's good, man. They're a really well-constructed team.
Yeah, I really am interested in that Bednar press conference, those comments after the game. Because I got to be real honest. Like, we record this once a week, so the series will be over. We got to sort of play with it in the moment. Acknowledging that Colorado could absolutely come back and win this series. If they don't, I do wonder how that's remembered and if that's seen as a meaningful moment in the series. Because I got to be honest, when that happened, when they came out and they won six straight and then they lost their first game and he goes out there and just rips on everyone, I thought it was great. Yeah. I really did. I was still sitting in my Leaf fan bitterness and I was like, yeah, this is what it sounds like when you have expectations of your star players. This is what it sounds like when an organization expects to win and not good enough is just not good enough. And I love the fact that even on the very first loss of the playoff run, that he was willing to plant that flag and say, we got to be much, much better than this. But three games later, it kind of feels like you're sitting there going, well, for a youngish team that's never had a deep run, maybe having the coach act like the first loss of the postseason after six straight wins when you've been looking great, having the coach react to that like it was a grade A crisis wasn't the right thing. I don't know.
I got a lot of shit, I remember, from somebody behind the scenes when I said that Bednar could be the guy before the guy as their coach. And I could see why you might not feel that way, because their regular season success has been great. And I think he's had success at every level as far as like winning championships. But yeah, I don't know. It's hard to gauge. Like, I feel like this is another Carolina situation where you shouldn't be too pissed off about losing to a really good team, but then maybe you should be because you should be the better team in theory, right?
Yeah.
In the series?
And again, you know, again, like much like Colorado, it's like – or much like Carolina, it's like Colorado is going to probably look quite a bit different next year because they got to figure out the Makar contract and everything, and that's not going to be freaking cheap. And like – again, you know, you can kind of accept, well, look, we didn't get the bounces, blah blah blah. Like you can accept that as a team or an organization or and even as a coach. But yeah, they're getting annihilated. They're not just like barely losing, like they're barely losing on the scoreboard, but that's their talent like keeping them in games they shouldn't be in.
Yeah. The point that I was going to make on Carolina before I ruined Greg's otherwise flawless transition was,
I mean, it was award winning.
My only point on that was I think Carolina's a real, real good team, but what concerns me if I'm them is the last three seasons have ended. This year against Tampa, you're out in five. Last year against the Bruins, you're out in five. The year before that, against the Bruins, you're out in four. So why is it that when we keep running into the elite teams, we're not just losing, but we're getting spanked?
I think they would say goaltending.
Well,
Carolina,
then go find a goaltender, and like you're not locked into who you got. But so that's Carolina. Mm-hmm. Colorado's a bit different. The thing with Colorado is, like, again, if they lose, and yeah, this 3 days from now, this whole conversation might sound stupid because Colorado's getting ready to play Montreal, and they're still the cup favorite, and all of that. But if they go out, at what point does this sort of become like almost like a Maple Leafs light situation where you're like, this team should have had a run in them at some point, and this will be yet another second round exit. And this goes back to not just the Bednar-Sakic management era, the MacKinnon era, even before that. Like, this blew me away. The Toronto Maple Leafs have played a conference final game more recently than the Colorado Avalanche have.
Jesus Christ.
Like, that seems insane, right? I mean, first of all, because to be able to say that about the Leafs and any team, but the Colorado, this is like one of the model franchises, one of the teams that's, you know, we know they had that dip a few years back, but this is a well-run team. This is a really good team, and yet it's like the Leaf situation with the dial turned down because they have one round, so it's not at the same level. But it's almost like, I don't know, I wonder when we start having that conversation. Like, do we start going like, what's the deal with Nathan MacKinnon? Like, he's been fantastic in the playoffs, not the last few games, but the beginning of this series, he was amazing last year. So it's not like he's just not producing. But, you know, is there something with the core? Is there something with coach? Is there something with whatever? Or do you just go, yeah, you know what? We're flipping coins, and sometimes a coin comes up to
yours.
Yeah,
especially. Especially because they're playing the team that tied them for the President's Trophy in the second round.
Yeah.
Yep.
Right. You know, like, I think that if, much like Carolina, you just go, well, fuck. I mean, you know, if you play seven games against a really good team, you know, you do have, like, a coin flip chance of either winning or losing, how, you know, four out of those seven games. Mm-hmm. If this was like a 21-game series, maybe it's going very differently, and you're not like, well, this is it, you know. But that's how it is, and I think in much the same way that this is true of Carolina, the format of the playoffs, not just this season, but like, oh, you know, the last several years, is kind of fucking Colorado. And obviously, you know, at some point you can't use that as an excuse because everybody has to come out of their own division and blah blah blah, and they keep not doing it. But this year in particular, it's like, yeah, we had to play the team for the President's Trophy. We had to play them again. And what are you going to do? Sometimes you're going to lose two or three games in a row.
Alex Newhook, Bowen Byram, two first rounders to Pittsburgh for Sidney Crosby. Who says no?
Probably Pittsburgh. Just, I mean, it's Sidney Crosby,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, Pittsburgh absolutely says no, but...
But what if Sidney Crosby says yes to go play with his friend and win a cup?
Does he want to? Yeah, I mean, you know, Does he want to? Like,
can I plant that seed? Can I incept this in the hockey world to get Sidney Crosby to play with Nathan MacKinnon and lead Colorado to the Cup? Like, well, to have a Messier-like impact on Colorado?
The other thing to say, of course, is that they're, again, it's his own fucking fault, but they're missing their number two center.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second, because this is obviously the third time that Nazem Kadri has done this in the playoffs, taken himself out of a series. As bad as I think it's been overshadowed because of how fucking dumb Scheifele was. But yeah, they miss him big time. I mean, the margins of the series are very tight. There's a lot of hockey being played where Nazem Kadri could make a huge difference. And what did we think about the neutral arbitrator not reducing that suspension? Because I think this is one of the only times that's happened when they've gone this far to this level.
I think he was right.
I think so too.
Yeah. But like, you know, it leaves Colorado in a bad spot because it's like, oh, JT Compher is our number two center, or Tyson Joe, you know, whoever you want to say is their number two guy. And it's like, oh yeah, he, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of sucks. Like, he's fine. But as a number two center, he kind of sucks. And you just end up going, yeah, I guess, you know, we're going to lose that the battle to the Carlson, Marchessault, Smith line, like every single time out now.
The thing I found really fascinating about the Kadri appeal was the fact that the Tom Wilson suspension reduction that happened was because the NHL like invented math to explain their decision. And then this time it was much more kind of in keeping with what they normally would do. And in fact, the Wilson suspension, which ended up around, what was it, 16 games 16 down from 20, was right, it?
20 down to 14, but he had already served more than that.
Oh, okay. So 20 down to 14. That helped inform this suspension. Mm-hmm. If you go by like the playoff multiplier, it's like 16 regular season games. And the arbitrator's like, yeah, this is the ballpark for what Kadri, a six-time repeat offender, should garner in the suspension. And
yeah.
I don't know. I always found it really strange that there was a cult of people online that were like saying that he got jobbed by the suspension. And I don't know if it's like,
do those people tend to have Denver zip codes? Is that?
No, it's not simply that. I think it's also kind of the people that are still reacting to the Panarin Wilson thing. And then,
yeah, which we can't, like, at some point, that can't, I mean, if you think it's a bad decision, which an awful lot of people did, okay, then it can't be, you can't then turn around and use that as a precedent for everything going forward in the name of consistency. Like, at some point, you can't sit here and say, it's ridiculous Tom Wilson didn't get suspended, he should have got 20 games for that, blah, blah, blah. And then when your guy does something, go, oh, well, but Tom Wilson.
Well, like, and that's really the thing, too, Sean. Like, what part of the Wilson thing was this notion of this is the guy that should get the big suspension because he's one of the only problematic people in the game insofar as doing this thing over and over again. And then fucking Kadri does it for, like, the sixth time, hitting somebody in the head. And this is exactly the person you're talking about.
Yeah.
And they gave him the commiserate. You should be happy. You should be happy.
Yeah.
Fuck it up this time.
I think it's – you got to remember, right? Like, when you appeal to the arbitrator, you're not appealing the Department of Player Safety decision. You're appealing Gary Bettman's decision.
Right. Like,
Gary Bettman very clearly wrote his decision. This was an open book test for him. He didn't have it for Tom Wilson, and he got nailed on it. He had he basically sat there with the arbitrator's decision from Tom Wilson and almost cut and pasted word for word the arguments back explaining why this would stand. And look, like, we've seen arbitrators reduce. We saw it for Tom Wilson. That was 20 games. We saw it for Weidman. That was 20 games. This is 8 games. What are you going to knock it down to, 7? You think the arbitrator is going to get himself fired over one game? I wasn't surprised at all, especially given that Bettman, like I said, could just go down a checklist and know exactly what he had to put in front of the arbitrator to make sure it wasn't going to get overruled.
Right. I don't know. It was interesting. I really did think it was going to get reduced and he might play, but made the right call. All right. Colorado, again, tough to talk about them because that series isn't over. But we forge ahead And you get to the series, the game that I will be going to after we get done taping this, the Boston Islanders series, which could end in Game 6 or go on to a Game 7. Obviously, the thing to talk about here is Bruce Cassidy. I was sitting next to Joe McDonald in the press box, who was with The Athletic and with ESPN. And he and I both knew that Cassidy was going to say something about the officiating after Game 5. And when he starts going in on the New York Saints fucking, they're swallowing what the Islanders are selling them kind of shit, he and I just looked at each other and just like bug-eyed. It's like, this is fucking fantastic. And then Cassidy went on for like 20 minutes.
So stupid by Cassidy for a million different reasons, but the big one is he got away with criticizing the refs after game, what was it, Game 4, I guess. He was like, oh, they don't call shit for us, blah, 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 whatever he said. And then the league didn't do anything. They let him say whatever he had to say, and that was it. But then
say his piece, yeah.
First of all, it didn't fucking work. Working the refs like this, they were like, yeah, we don't give a shit about you complaining to the media. Although I guess again, like Barry Trotz going, well, Patrice Bergeron, who's 1 for 87 at the dot in this series, is cheating on faceoffs, and so they kicked him out of like 9 faceoffs in that game. But you know, he returned to the scene of the crime, and the cops were like, oh yeah, we would happily arrest you for being stupid enough to fucking complain about this again. I don't understand why he would do it, other than he thinks it's gonna, like, have the fucking effect of
that's getting the call.
But, like, it did. He already did it, and it didn't work. And well, and now the Boston media is so mentally destroyed by this that they're like, well, they're finally shaking up the refs. It's like, yeah, they've changed the refs after every fucking game.
That was such a stupid article. That was written by somebody who doesn't know how the playoffs work.
But they're all doing it. Now they're all report breathlessly. Oh, dispatch just in from the NHL. Extra, extra, read all about it. It's two different guys. Yeah, no fucking shit, you morons.
I think he was genuinely pissed off that the Islanders worked the refs, and I think his evidence that the Islanders worked the refs was the fact that Barry Trotz called out Patrice Bergeron for cheating in the faceoff circle. Patrice Bergeron got tossed in the faceoff circle like 3 times in the first period. Like, it's I don't blame him. Like, I'd be pissed off too. But and I think what really set him off, and I was there for the game, and I agree with him, is they had like a shot attempt advantage of like triple what the Islanders had in that game. Like, their zone time was sick. Like, yes, there's no reason
why. They dominated that game,
especially the first period. The idea that the Islanders would have like 3 power plays before the Boston Bruins had one was fucking insane. He had every right to bitch about it. He just went in a little bit. He cut a little deep. Deeper than I expected.
Yeah. Yeah.
With that press conference.
And the other thing is, like, I said this on Twitter yesterday, but 3 Bruins in this series have gotten max fines that got a combined penalty in game of 2 minutes in the box that didn't result in any goals for the Islanders, right? Right. Who was it? DeBrus got away with cross-checking someone in front of the net, just like in the back of the head. No two ways about it, that happened. Krejci got his spear reduced from a major to a minor because the refs decided, well, look, he got cross-checked a bunch of times by Barzal. And, like, yeah, that should have been a 5 and a 2 instead of a 2 and a 0. But, it, you know, they still lucked out insofar as David Krejci got to keep playing. And then who was it? It was Nick Ritchie just fucking elbows a guy in the head, no call on the ice. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, you're not fucking, like, you're getting away with shit constantly. You're just not getting the power plays, like. I to your point, I get why he's pissed, because, you know, the idea that the team that has the puck that much shouldn't have drawn any power plays is crazy. I agree with that on some level, but in the larger extent of the context of the series, it's like, yeah, you've gotten away with a shitload. Like, maybe don't make too much of a fucking stink about it.
Who has a better shot at beating the Lightning, the Islanders or the Bruins?
I think they both got a shot. I mean, I'm not sure that I would put one significantly ahead of the other.
I guess you would say the team with the two scoring lines as opposed to one. But then again, the Bruins are kind of in a tough situation with their defense, where it's like, oh yeah, we have to play two guys who aren't good every single night because nobody's healthy.
By the one scoring line, do you mean the Clutterbuck line?
That's, or? Yeah, no. Okay. Greg, I think you mean the identity line. Yeah, the word. Again, well, another.
Speaking of nicknames, how great is it that they've christened the Marchessault line the Misfit line, the Golden Misfit line? Like, that's beautiful. Like, that's their link
to the. I don't
give
a shit. Who cares?
That's a great nickname. It's good. It's a great nickname. I like it a lot.
But
we've talked about it in the show that there are no good nicknames for lines anymore.
Yeah.
It's called by like the name of one player, the McKinnon line.
Yeah. And that continues with the Misfit line. We already did this gimmick. It's over.
All right.
But you know, again, like this is a Boston cottage industry of anytime anybody says the perfection line, like 40 Boston, beat writers have to go, actually, nobody calls them that. And it's like, they call them that constantly. That's why you tweet about it all the time. Mm. So, you know, the identity line is the exact same shit where it's like, don't call them that. And it's like, I mean, don't call them that, but like, you're not going to stop them.
So I believe it's pronounced cottage, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I just say on Cassidy, a couple things. First of all, obligatory sour Leafs fan, a Bruins coach complaining that things are getting let go in the playoffs is a little rich. Just a little rich. I think people need to remember when it comes to working the refs, there's two levels to this. There's every series has got like a series supervisor, and the teams have access to that person, and that's in theory where you're supposed to go to do this stuff. And it happens all the time. And you know, the Bergeron face-off thing, yeah, Trotz mentioned it publicly, but I'm sure that was something where they sat down and said, hey, look at what this guy's doing. Keep an eye on this. Like, that's where you get to tell the supervisor, like, hey, watch out for this or watch out for that. They're interfering with us on face-offs. They're doing this, they're doing that. Watch this player, watch this situation. And then a lot of times that will translate to calls, but we don't know about it because we're not part of the conversations. And that's how the league wants it. It's when guys go and do it publicly like this that it becomes a little bit dicey, because sometimes it works. But now also the refs are going, okay, I'm under pressure to call it a certain way, but also everybody knows I'm under pressure to call it that way. So if I do call it that way, now I look like I just got played by the coach. So, you know, sometimes it backfires.
Right. It also goes back to the thing that I always joke about is when, you know, fans are chanting, ref, you suck. It's like, no, you should be saying they're good at their jobs, and then they like you and want to give you power plays.
Exactly.
I mentioned this during Game 5, but, like, I want to see the first NHL arena where the fans go apoplectic and they chant, ref, you suck, and then they see the replay on the Jumbotron and they realize that the refs got it right. And then I want to hear a chant referencing that, like,
yeah,
hey, we're sorry, or
that's on us, yeah,
just that's on us, or our bad, yeah. Our bad, you know, just give me that once.
I've said this before, if any NHL crowd, like any fan base, ever developed the reputation of actually being smart about calls, and like where you could say, like, oh, when they boo, it's because the ref really did miss something, that would be like the most massively powerful home ice advantage.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it will never happen because, like, you know, what, like a guy clubs someone else over the head with their stick on the opening faceoff and gets a penalty, and the crowd immediately starts doing the ref you suck chant, and it's like,
yeah, no, exactly. Like, all you need to know about it is there's Avalanche fans defending Kadri. He didn't deserve to get rung up for that much. There's Capitals fans who go, Tom Wilson has literally never done anything wrong. He just plays hard and all that shit. And it's like, yeah, no, if you're a fan of a team, you're too stupid to like look at a tripping penalty and be like, you know what, fair enough.
Speaking of which, have we heard anything on Palat, on that hit on Pesci? Like,
you know, I will look it up because I do
time.
Not believe
there's,
that we did.
We've got, you know, there's a few days off for Tampa, but
they're
that's
usually
one
pretty
that
prompt.
I think they
yeah,
will get. Yeah.
NHL players have
usually
that, I mean,
quick,
it looked
but that's
pretty
usually because the next game is the next day, yeah. So maybe they take an extra day. But I haven't seen anything certainly saying he's getting a hearing, but I also sometimes you see the tweet from somebody saying all clear. Because yeah. that one it. Wasn't
that was it was
it wasn't Kadri, but it's that yeah. absolutely
pretty bad.
Okay. A couple of awards thingies. I mean, I don't. I actually just won awards thingy. The Norris came out today, and Victor Hedman was nominated for it. He was not on my ballot. I got to be honest with you. I was a voter this year, or it was only 100 of us. If you didn't hear that, because they tried to kind of laser focus it on the different divisions because of the way the season went. And Emily and I are both kind of like at large national voters. Hedman was not on my ballot. I didn't think that he had a year as good as his standards are, and I didn't think he had a year as good as some other defensemen's years were. But he is your Patrice Bergeron-esque, put it in pencil before the season as a finalist name, and he makes the top three.
Yeah, the thing I think about that. The thing I think back to is when we did like mid-season awards picks, you had Hedman as one of your three or four or five guys, whatever, and I was like, yeah, but he's like playing badly. And you said, well, right, but I mean, he usually figures it out before the end of the season. And it's like, yep, that's people were just like, I'll figure it out next year. Fuck it. You know, like, right. It's a total reputation call, and that's
usually,
it.
But he usually does figure it out by the end of the season. But then I looked up like, oh, fuck, the season's got like 13 games left. And then he was terrible.
Yeah.
Because he was hurt.
And like, let's put it this way. There were articles in which he said, oh, I haven't been good this year. And it's not because I'm playing hurt. Wink. And then like 2 weeks later, they were like, oh, it's because he was playing hurt this whole time. I don't know if you knew about this. And so, like, this is the easiest season where, again, Victor Hedman is a world-class defenseman who had a bad year, in part because he was hurt. And so you have the easiest excuse. This is the year I look elsewhere. And whatever, 60% of PHWA voters were like, well, I didn't fucking pay attention to any of that shit this year. What do I care? And like, I literally said on the thing, like, when the ballots come out, look and see who had him in their top three. Those are the guys you know for sure didn't fucking pay attention this year. For sure. And Pierre LeBrun 2 minutes later was like, look, I had all three of these guys in my top three. So and it's like, no, yeah, exactly.
I had.
If we're saying Pierre LeBrun doesn't pay attention, then I don't.
Well, look, what other possible reason would you have to put him in the top three?
Look, here's the thing. Victor Hedman is, most people would agree, if not one of the best defensemen in the league in terms of if you were starting a team and you had one season to play, he's the guy you're going to pick. Didn't have a great year by his standards, but he's kind of the default setting for what people think of as a great defenseman. And the reality is you look around at the rest, if this was a year where there were other guys having real dominant years, then, yeah, he doesn't get the votes. But it's been a weird year where, first of all, there weren't any, like, Adam Fox had the big breakout, but there wasn't, like, a John Carlson-type year where somebody just, just had everything going in, racks up the big point totals the voters want. There were the other main candidate. I mean, Cale Makar is great, obviously, but now you're getting – there's a lot of young guys, and this has always been an award that has a certain level of – lifetime achievement to it. So I'm not surprised that given how the whole thing played out, that some writers are going to look at it and say, yeah, there's a lot of young guys here that, yeah, who knows? I mean, is this going to be our give Jim Carrey the Vezina moment if we give it to some younger guy who's not all that proven? I'm going to find a spot on my ballot for one or two comfort food, great defensemen that I know are really good. And
so vote for fucking Drew Doughty then. Who gives a shit at that point? Like, if you're just saying, you know what? It's a reputation thing, sure. But, like,
reputation plays into it. Because voters want votes that are going to hold up well. They don't want to look back and be like, oh, yeah, remember that year we gave Chris Kunitz one of the All-Star slots? And maybe it shouldn't be that way. I absolutely think you can make a case for that. But it's just this idea that people don't watch or they don't pay attention.
There's like, no explanation for a guy who admitted he wasn't good this year in the media on the same site you
by
work
his standards,
for.
Yeah.
Right, but like by his standards, he's usually a top three or four defenseman in the league, and this year he was like, oh, I wasn't close to that. It's like, no, that's right. You're maybe like a top 15 defenseman in the league
top
this year.
10, maybe even top 10, but like that I do think this might be one of those like eye tests, stats tests type deals. Like you watch Victor Hedman play and he's Victor Hedman. He does his Victor Hedman things. He's quite good. You get into the numbers of it and you realize that it really was not a very good year for him by his standards. And
well, I mean, here's what it boils
down
to. Not a
good year. Go ahead.
Well, you know, by his standards, you know, if that's what we're saying, like it wasn't a good year, except he racked up a lot of assists. That's it. Right. And if we want to say, you know what, I just sorted by points. Well, fair enough, I guess. You know, but just say that that's what you did, I guess, is my point. Because in much the same way, the Vezina Award this year, the goalies that were nominated, I'm sure total coincidence, were the three guys with the most wins in the league.
Well, that's not the thing.
And that's always
the
case.
Oh, I understand it isn't.
And it's the GMs. And the GMs, I disagree with their picks quite often, and I think they emphasize the wrong things. It doesn't mean the GMs aren't watching hockey because they pick guys that I wouldn't have picked for the award.
Well, this year in particular, I feel like, you know, how many times have we heard, you know, I've only watched the teams I've played this year. It's happened. It's come up a lot. So, like the idea that a GM is just even more so going to lean into, well, we'll just sort by wins and go from there. Like,
but you know, the thing is, on Sean's reputation point, where this gets interesting is a drop off for a guy like Hedman. What does that still mean commiserate to the rest of the league? Like we've talked about this with Bergeron before. Like he's had seasons where he's not been Bergeron, but he's still like leaps and bounds better than most defensive forwards in this league. And so if you wanted to put Hedman on your ballot, maybe I take some issue if you have him first. But if you wanted to put him on and just say, you know, he wasn't himself, but he was still better than most, I can maybe get down with that. I didn't have him on mine, but I think Ryan, where you're right is like if the people that might have him first, like you got to get into the numbers a little bit and realize what you're voting for here.
Yeah, like either take it seriously or say I'm not going to vote anymore because I'm not taking it seriously, and I'd like a writer who will to do it instead.
Well, I think most take it seriously. I just think that maybe people have different standards for it. Like I agree with Sean. Like Pierre takes it seriously. He just maybe doesn't approach the evaluation.
Yeah, and there's going to be, again, like, and we're going to do this stupid dance when the ballots come out, where everyone's going to go combing through looking for, and yeah, there'll be a couple of writers that'll have done dumb things just to get attention and get a column out of it. But most people put a lot of work into this stuff, and I'm sorry if the results don't match what you personally would have done. And it's very possible that you're right and they're wrong. That's happened a lot. But people put a lot of work into this. I don't have a ballot this year, by the way. I know people are probably wondering where I didn't have to do it. So I'm coming at this fresh. I don't know where I would have had Hedman if I would have had him at all. But I don't know. I know a lot of people who vote on this stuff, and I don't know anyone who just tosses it off in a couple of minutes the way people seem to
think. I did have a ballot, and I could tell you my top three were, in fact, Ty Smith, PK Subban, and Damon Severson.
So wow.
I think I'm
good.
Very reasonable.
All right, a couple more things. First of all, I believe it's July 8th is the date. National holiday in both U.S. and Canada. It is the day that season 2 of I Think You Should Leave hits.
July 6th, by the way.
Is it 6th?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Because it's like I remember being like, it's after 4th of July weekend. Like, but just barely. And I looked to see if that was still like, you know, what day the 4th of July fell on. And it's like, no, it's just like the Tuesday after 4th of July weekend. There's no... But I was like, I want to clear my fucking schedule for this, so...
Are you worried that it's now, like, anticipated? The one of the true joys of that show was that it snuck up on everybody.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, can they follow it up? Is it yeah. Can they do the sophomore album that so many bands fumbled?
And that is going to be big, but man, like, I remember, right? Like, I didn't watch it at first. It was a couple days in. Ryan, you were selling it hard, so like it didn't sneak up on me. I went in and I was like, this better be the funniest damn thing ever to live up to everyone talking about it. And I was like, no, it's better. So
it's better.
I mean, I'll be crushingly disappointed if it's not. And you know, as soon, like, it's going to hit, and 30 seconds later, idiots will be on Twitter like, there wasn't anything as good as the Chunky sketch. It's like,
hot dogs.
Give it a minute. But
the thing that gives me pause is I remember, like, the second season of Flight of the Conchords, it was so obvious that they crammed every good idea that they had into the first season.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm a little bit worried about that. I'm a little bit worried about, like, all of the A material made this perfect season of television, and now they had to come up with new shit.
Well,
and maybe it won't be as good.
My answer to that is, of course, that the episode of Characters that Tim Robinson did is just as good. Like, every sketch is just as good as anything from the first season of I Think You Should Leave. So and also all the stuff where they were like, oh, did you know Tim Robinson wrote this insanely funny SNL sketch and it's one of the four he got on air? And it's like, yeah, this is insanely fucking funny. I think I'm going to trust the process on this one, I guess.
In Tim we trust.
Yeah.
All right. Overrated, underrated, favorite, least favorite for this week. We turn our attention to a bracket created by The Hockey News, a partner of BetMGM. Who did us back in March did a full 32 team bracket, 32 song bracket of hockey songs. Now some of these are songs about hockey, and then some of these are songs that you hear at hockey games. And I realize now that I'm talking this through, they clearly did this as a March Madness gimmick. And yet the voting seems to be continuing in June. So, I don't know, man. Something went awry. Maybe they forgot about it or some shit. But anyways, it's on my Twitter, and you can find it there. And you can find it on the Hockey News' Twitter. But it's a full bracket. And so we're going to do overrated, underrated, favorite, least favorite songs in this bracket that are like most of the shit that you'd hear at an arena, or they're about hockey.
With the acknowledgement that we're looking at this list and we're going, yeah, I don't know what the fuck O Ellen is. and, like, I don't think Olay, like, chanting Olay counts as a song, really.
But there's a song, there's an Olay song, though, that they play. It's a goal song for some teams, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. So, well, clearly that's not going to be on your list. What is your most overrated song from this collection?
It's the number one seed. It's the hockey song. This is
come on.
This is classic. Please Like My Sport song. That's all it is to me. I hear that song and I go, okay, sure. You know, Bobby score. Yeah, okay. That shit might have worked as like a get. This is like saying, oh, my favorite scary song, the Monster Mash. It's a gimmick song. Get lost,
man.
Wait, is that a thing? Your favorite scary song? Is that a genre?
Yeah, well, ask Rob Zombie if that's a genre. He made a fucking whole career out of it.
Oh, then the answer is Dragula, which should actually be on this list now, I think.
Yeah, and by the way, that song rips, so.
That song rocks.
Yeah, well, it I would say it digs through the witches and burns through the witches and slams, personally. Yeah. In the back of my Dragula.
Mm-hmm. Hockey song's great. I would agree that if that song came out like now, you'd be like, why are you doing this? But considering it's 50 years old or whatever, it's a good song. My overrated is Seven Nation Army. I don't understand why this. It's fine. I'm not like a huge White Stripes guy, but that's sure. I'm not going to say it's a bad song, but I don't understand why it became like this arena staple in every sport. I don't know. It doesn't work.
It's that bass line. It's the bass line. That's it.
It's bass line, but like, does that get you like out of your seat and like ready to watch hockey or, you know, see somebody get their head cracked open?
Well,
football,
the worldwide
just, like,
evidence. The worldwide evidence would suggest that yes, it definitely is.
I guess.
Well, that's the thing that's I like about it is that it's graduated from song into chant.
Yes.
Like now the chants just happen and you don't even need the song as a prompt. They happen all the time at Islanders games just on their own, which I think is really cool. But it might speak to why it's an overrated song and the fact that it's now superfluous. It's not necessary.
There you go. Save yourself on those licensing fees and just do it.
Overrated for me is Sandstorm. Enough.
Named after famed LA Kings winger Thomas Sandstorm, who went on to a career as a crappy European DJ. Yeah.
As opposed to underrated Devils forward Patrick Sunstorm.
Yeah, he was good.
Yeah, Sandstorm. I feel like we've come so far in the world of electronic music that we don't have to do this anymore. We can go with other stuff. So that's my overrated is Sandstorm. Underrated, Ryan.
This is a tough one. Because I'm looking at this list and there's like a lot of song. You know what? I'm going to say... I'm assuming that Sweetness is the Jimmy World song Sweetness, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that song's fucking awesome.
That was my underrated.
Yeah.
I'll jump the queue and say that was what I was going to pick. That song fucking rules.
Yeah, it's so good.
And
gonna have to go.
I imagine
to that,
like
I have no idea what song that is.
Oh,
if you played NHL 2003, you or four okay. maybe
yeah.
around that era, you have 100% heard this song a million times. It was on the soundtrack. You'll recognize it instantly. It rocks.
It is peak emo. Like, it is just like the heart's not even on your sleeve. Like, your entire outfit is the heart at this point. Like, it's so good and so of its moment, and probably just cranks over arena speakers too. So Sweetness is mine as well.
That's a good one.
Underrated.
I'll have to check. My underrated was we talked a little bit off air about Big League by Tom Cochran, which is a great song and one of the you Americans took Life as a Highway and ruined it by turning it into a crappy country song. So this is a fantastic song. But I had it on my list as my underrated, but I'm not convinced. Like, the topic is arena songs, and I'm not convinced it's a great arena song. So I'm gonna go with one that they had as a pretty high seed, which is Get Ready for This. Classic early 90s, perfect, like, arena, like, the 93.
That's the Jock Jam song, right?
Yeah.
That's the Jock Jam song, yeah.
Yeah, it is the Jock, which, hey, it just Jock Jams as a genre of music is pretty stacked. So when you are the Jock Jam song, respect.
Yeah, the only way to beat it in terms of Jock Jams is that, Michael Jordan era Bulls entrance music is like, fuck, yeah. man.
But that's only good for the Bulls. I mean, have you ever heard
that
hockey game music. And you're like, yeah. what are you doing?
Yeah.
Yeah, like it became iconic with that one team, and now it's like, well, you can't. It's like if a different wrestler came out to the John Cena Rapidoo thing. You'd be like, get out of
exactly
here.
Exactly what it is.
This is not the Rapidoo, man.
Favorite song, Ryan.
This is a tough one because there's Metallica, there's AC/DC, there's the Oz man himself, Ozzy Osbourne. But I think I have to go with For Whom the Bell Tolls. Fucking song's incredible.
It really is.
Da-da-da-da-da. Yeah. Oh, the intro is good, but like also, The middle part of the song is good. The chorus is good. The bridge is good. Well, like, you can, like, there, what I'm saying is you can take that, like, any part of that song and make it part of your arena pump-up thing, and it works. Like, oh, they're coming out onto really the ice. Point. Here's the intro to For Whom the Bell Tolls. Oh, they're about to start a power play. Here's the chorus for Whom the Bell Tolls. Like, it just works no matter where you start it, I guess is the point.
And we should mention that there's a couple of different categories of songs in this bracket. Like, they haven't parsed it out this way. Maybe they should have made these regions. But I think I grouped together, like, Hell's Bells and Crazy Train and For Whom the Bell Tolls together. Like, there's songs
the
that
best
have great
ones.
Intros. No. They have, like, great intros. Like, even though the beginning of Crazy Train isn't the hard rocking part, the minute you hear All Aboard, it's iconic, and everybody in the arena perks up when they hear it.
Yeah.
Because they know it's going to start slamming in about 15 seconds.
Yeah. Yeah. And the,
so it's like there's
we've talked about how, like, wrestling entrance songs, the first 3 seconds is the key. And I feel like arena songs are kind of like that. You've either got to have – even the ones that have a long build, I need to know right away what I'm in for. You can't meander around. Like, you got to get right to it.
The reason I didn't pick Hell's Bells, by the way, which is an incredible song, great arena song, is it's not the best AC/DC arena pump-up song, which is, of course, Thunderstruck.
Damn right. Favorite. I mean, Sean, should we just skip this? Because, it's obviously Welcome to the Jungle
is the obvious one. 35 years old, and it's still the go-to pre-kickoff song in, like, half the NFL arenas. It's near perfect, but I do have to say, I do have to say, yeah, exactly. And you feel welcome, right? Because you might be a little intimidated
if you're in the jungle. Well, he does say, welcome to the jungle, you're going to die.
It's an explicit threat.
There's fun and games.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's
the problem is you do have to learn to live like an animal, you know? And, like, I don't know. I don't always feel like I want to put in that effort.
It takes effort because he's got it.
The problem is you have to put an effort because you can get the bright lights, but you can't get them for free.
So the rest of this podcast is just going to be us reading the lyrics.
Yeah, just doing a 1987 riff on
just the bit
we're in front of a brick wall.
7 minutes. It's going to be, but the sha na 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 na. Okay, anyways. But I do want to say very, very close honorable mention to Enter Sandman. Which is it to me? It's an A level hockey, basketball, football, and an A++ baseball. Even though Mariano Rivera kind of made it a little too much his own, right? But
and yet an S tier wrestling entrance. Because when you watch ECW pay per views on WWE Network. And they dub it over with some generic fucking song. You're like, this sucks.
Yeah. Did you know, by the way, I'm sure you guys did, but I did, that the Sandman originally was like a surfer gimmick?
Yes.
And that's why I found that out just like a week ago, and it blew my mind that like him coming out like as a surfboard and that he's the Sandman. Anyways.
Surfboard. All right. My favorite from this list, I want to give a shout out to Enter Sandman, like you said, and I want to give a shout out to Crazy Train, like we talked about. But I'm gonna keep it simple, man. There's nothing more inspiring than hearing an entire arena sing "We Will Rock You," not just hearing the beat, but hearing the arena sing it is one of my favorite things. So. I mean, it's chalk, right? It's like betting the favorite, but We Will Rock You is my favorite.
It's another gimmick song by a gimmick band. You know, it's the thing. They have like 9 songs that get played by in arenas, and it's like, yeah, no, we know. There's like the drum part, and then you chant, and okay, yeah, great. Like the whole oeuvre there is just kind of designed for that sort of thing.
Well, and it's designed to get over when performed in like a massive stadium, which I think kind of kicks ass. It just happens that correlates pretty well to sports arenas.
You know what I think it is? I think that fucking movie was so bad that I just hate Queen reflectively now. Like, I just hear a Queen song and I go, oh, we fucking get it with the big teeth. I know, I got it. That's fine.
All right, least favorite song here.
This is a tough one, but this is a band I have never gotten ever in my whole life. And as someone who recently discovered he likes the Grateful Dead, I kind of dread the day where Rush starts making sense to me. So Tom Sawyer, I think, is kind of a dud.
Mm. Uh-oh, Sean.
No, you know what? I do like Tom Sawyer as a arena song, but I was never a big Rush guy. So, mine is Chelsea Dagger. I'm just, you know what? I'm tired of watching other teams win Stanley Cups. Screw all.
Yeah, I don't think you have to worry about that for quite a while to come, Sean.
Yeah. Other teams.
My choice is a bit of chalk, I guess, again, and recency bias, because I look at this entire bracket and I see some of my favorite hard rock and arena songs of all time, and then I see a one-season forgettable send the t-shirts to a third-world country gimmick of Gloria from the St. Louis Blues, which obviously shouldn't even be in this bracket. Not a bad song, not a great, but a terrible arena song, and a song that will be forgotten into history like We Are Family was for the Pittsburgh Pirates in the 1970s, I think it was.
Well, you seem to remember it, so.
Oh, fuck off. That's not my point.
But owned by your own logic sucks.
I know.
You hate to find yourself in that position.
I hate being that smart, yeah.
You know what I noticed about this list is, we mentioned it earlier, no wrestling songs on here. Like, no The Game that I saw, right? And that song's incredible.
That's what other ones would there be? I don't know. There were a few others. Like, I was like, no Cotton Eye Joe. Come on.
That's I think that's fine. But yeah, I mean, at that point, you're like YMCA and okay, sure. Yeah. But right. So at that point, you're like, what's the track list to Jock Jam's One?
Honestly, that wouldn't be a bad way to go.
Yeah, that's true.
The one I felt was missing was Jump Around by House of Pain. I felt like was one that
is
that
a good one
on the list. Yeah,
it also worked in Mrs. Doubtfire.
Did Drive By Fruitings. All right,
Pierce Brosnan's so fucking funny in that movie.
He's so good in that movie.
We love Pierce Brosnan on this podcast,
don't we, folks? All right, that's Puxy for this week. Thanks for listening. You can check out my column on ESPN.com on Thursdays. And check out all the coverage from me and Emily on the playoffs there as well. I'll be covering the East, and she is out West, and probably not Canada this next round, but maybe Canada in the final if they make it through. Who's to say?
Again, I don't think you have to worry too much about that, but okay.
All right. Go ahead, Ryan.
EPRinkside.com. I have continued my series of what should blank that just got eliminated do with their roster this summer. Last 2 days, I did the Hurricanes and the Jets for obvious reasons. And if you want to sign up for a year's subscription at EP Ringside, I love EP, all one word, all capital letters. I think capitalization might matter. I don't know. And you'll get an extra 3 months for free, which is, wow, what a deal. And also, of course, sign up for the Puck Soup Patreon, where we are doing tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Eastern, a live call-in show on our Discord where we'll, you know, take questions and people will play game shows. And we'll probably watch the start of Game 6 of the Colorado-Vegas series together and all at different times because of streaming and stuff like that. So it'll be really funny when I react to a goal and Sean's like, I'm 30 seconds behind. So thanks.
Right.
Check that out. And I have a newsletter on there. Me and Sean Gentile do Stick to Sports on there. Mailbag we're about to record. And then bonus episodes twice a month. So check her out.
You can find my stuff on The Athletic, you can hear me on The Athletic Hockey Show with Ian Mendez on Thursdays.
There you go. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. We will talk to you next week. Bye.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Sticks and hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to an FL commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Part 2.